This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Thursday, March 31st. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Since the terrorist attacks in Brussels last week, the presidential candidates have been speaking more specifically about foreign policy and homeland security. On Monday, Donald Trump appeared on Fox and Friends.
NATO is obsolete. We're paying the lion's share. We're spending tremendous amounts of money on something that was many, many decades ago, and the world has changed. It's a different place. There's no emphasis on terror with NATO, and frankly, if there is, you need different countries because it involves different countries.
Evan Osnos is here to talk about the latest turn in traditional party politics. Hi, Evan.
Hi, Dorothy.
So that was a breathtaking statement, although it got a little lost in the attack on Ted Cruz's wife and Trump's comment and retraction about punishing women who get abortions. But we will move along. Tell us a little bit about what in the world he was talking about.
As is often the case, it's hard to know how much of this is deeply held and how much of this is sort of ad hoc. But whether he's doing this to position himself away from his Republican rivals or to try to differentiate himself in a general election, he's outlined what can only be described as an eclectic vision of American foreign policy. And so, you know, in addition to calling NATO obsolete, he also says that American allies, for instance, in Asia, should pay for U.S. protection. He says the United States should be neutral in a conflict in the Middle East. All of these are squarely, thoroughly, I mean, completely at odds with the Republican Party's traditional positions. And it's forced not only Republican voters into an awkward position, but it's really forced the Republican establishment, the foreign policy thinkers who have been so central to American policy over the last generation, to decide whether or not they would still be part of a Republican party that is led by Donald Trump.
He also suggested that South Korea and Japan should have access to nuclear weapons and said he wouldn't rule out using nukes on the Islamic State.
Yeah, this is one of those moments where you see that, as it is with domestic issues in some cases, you almost hear him working these ideas out for the very first time in public, in front of the world. We're entering a phase now where I think analysts and interviewers realize how little Trump really understands about basic facts about our geopolitical situation, and therefore they can ask him questions and realize that he really doesn't know what he's going to say before he opens his mouth. And so when he was asked recently by the New York Times in a long interview about foreign policy, he was asked whether he would consider using tactical nuclear weapons in the Middle East or even in Europe. And he sort of said, look, I am unpredictable. I can't say that I will and I can't say that I won't. But the idea that he even entertains the notion is basically regarded as ludicrous. I mean, I really struggle.
So both Obama and Secretary of State Kerry have talked about how alarmed other nations are and totally bewildered at the spectacle of Trump as the Republican frontrunner. You lived in Beijing for years. What do you hear from China?
Most of the reaction that you're hearing so far comes from elsewhere in Asia. And we often forget that just a couple of syllables from an American politician at his level is treated as very serious in parts of the world where we have a presence. So, for instance, to give you an example, Trump has said that he would require Tokyo and Seoul to pay for the presence of U.S. troops in those countries. And the governments have been officially muted. They're trying not to overreact to what Trump says. But as a practical fact, they have to see that the comments from the leading American Republican candidate are not inconsequential. So the governor of Osaka, for instance, which is the third largest city in Japan, he said, look, we have a duty to prepare for the possibility of a Trump candidacy because it would shake the foundation of our security. So even though they might want to say, look, we consider this to be just American political pyrotechnics, they can't pretend that this doesn't exist. Countries, whether we're talking about Japan or South Korea, or the Philippines, or in Europe, frankly, countries that are engaged in this very complicated triangulation between the United States and China, a rising power, and Russia, they have to think about whether or not the United States in a Trump presidency would still be a guarantor of their security, whether in fact it would live up to the commitments that have been the basis of global security really since the post-war era began.
What about China's response to Trump's trade policy, which has been a centerpiece of his campaign?
Trump is not big news in China because as much as he talks about China, and he often likes to say that he's got business over there and that he's struck deals with China over the years. He's not a consequential figure. Most people haven't heard of him. The government has made ritual statements that object to Trump's characterization of the trade relationship as being exploitative in the United States. They say that, in fact, it's benefited both sides. Privately, though, I think their biggest bewilderment is that the rules of American politics that they really have come to rely on no longer seem to be operative. I mean, the number one, they look at American politics and they said, the brother of a president, the son of a former president, that person should reasonably become the United States president. Because certainly that's how it would work in Chinese politics. And then on top of it, now you have this very unusual figure, somebody who their models never predicted.
And then there's Ted Cruz. There's a big primary coming up next week in Wisconsin, and he seems to be gaining some ground there. He appears to be clearly less hawkish than Hillary Clinton. I was reminded this morning that Ryan Lizza quoted him in a piece for the magazine some months ago at the beginning of the campaign, saying that he closely adheres to Reagan's foreign policy and that, as he put it, historically America has always been reluctant to engage in military force. Cruz also opposed Obama's request to Congress in 2013 to strike Syria.
Well, Cruz is a wild card in this scenario. If Cruz turns out to be a serious challenger for Donald Trump, this will force the Republican foreign policy establishment to decide whether or not they line up with a Cruz presidency. Because what's happening at the moment is that some of the most powerful figures in the Republican foreign policy establishment have basically come out publicly and said that they would never under any circumstances support a Donald Trump presidency. What's now up to more than 100 Republican foreign policy thinkers signed a letter that said that his vision of American influence swings between, and I think their characterization is right, swings between isolationism and military adventurism in the space of one sentence. And so a number of them, including, for instance, Robert Kagan, who was a liberal interventionist, as he calls himself, who supported the war in Iraq, Max Boot, who's a military historian at the Council on Foreign Relations, they have come out and said that really there's no competition here. They would support a Hillary Clinton candidacy over a Donald Trump candidacy.
Yes, so is Nicholas Burns, who was the Undersecretary of State under George W. Bush. He told the Wall Street Journal the same thing because she's for engagement in the world. And Michael Hayden, who was a George W. Bush CIA director, has said that he would support Hillary over any Republican except Kasich.
Yeah, some of this, I think, is sort of wise career management. They're looking around the corner and they see that we're probably going to have, if all things remain as they are now, we're looking at a Clinton presidency. And it is a surprising fact, I think, that if you look at the range of leading Democratic politicians today, Hillary Clinton is certainly closer to the establishment wing of the Republican Party than others would have been, Joe Biden or Elizabeth Warren or certainly Bernie Sanders. And the traditional foreign policy and defense problem for Democrats in a presidential election has always been the idea that they are squishy. You know, it's summed up in the image of Michael Dukakis wearing
yes,
the helmet.
Absolutely.
That became the iconic image of Democratic weakness. And also, by extension, it was the core of Republican strength, that no matter what else Republicans were saying that may be out of step economically with where Americans are, that they would often come down on the side of a strong defense and assertive American presence. Those roles not only are tossed up in the air because of the individual personalities in this race, but even the parties themselves, I think, are in the midst of a deep transformation about what it means to be a Republican foreign policy president and ultimately what a Democrat can do in office.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
One of the questions here is where the public stands on involvement in foreign wars.
You have a very palpable sense of fatigue after all of these years of the American expenditure of blood and treasure in the Middle East and Afghanistan. The first person to pick up on that as an important element in presidential politics was Rand Paul.
Yeah.
You remember, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, we were talking about the fact that Rand Paul had identified what became known as the stay-at-home Republicans. These were people who were just exhausted by the consequence of everything that had come in the years since September 11th. And people call Trump this, he's sort of the lint catcher of politics. He just picks up things all over the place. And he has a sense of individual issues that resonate with segments of the public. And one of those issues is this desire for a more reserved foreign policy. And so he's incorporated that in, but he hasn't incorporated it in as an ideologically coherent position. But, you know, what do we know about what the voters think? At the moment, Trump is doing a little bit better than you might expect among voters when it comes to foreign policy and defense. After the Paris attacks, for instance, there was a poll that showed that Americans say they trust Clinton to handle terrorism over Trump by a margin of 50 to 42. Some other polls have put her lead larger than that. But in the end, foreign policy is not usually the number one issue that people vote on. At the moment, only about 10% of registered voters say that foreign policy is their number one issue. But if we continue to have terrorist attacks between now and November, and if there is, God forbid, something else on American soil, then where the two candidates come down will become a larger piece of the chemistry.
We keep hearing about the Stop Donald Trump movement, and it actually has a number of different arms. Where do the neocons stand on Trump, and how actively involved are they in the Stop Trump crusade?
I think one of the surprises has been that the neocons have actually been some of the most forceful advocates for a Stop Trump campaign. Now, what I don't know is whether they're organizing formally, whether, in fact, they're raising money against Trump or whether they are participating in the maneuvering about what might go into a Republican convention to challenge a Trump nomination. By all the public indications, there's more than a sort of sentimental view that Republican thinkers have to do more than just voice their opposition to Trump, because the fate of the party is actually truly in the balance here. You know, there was a piece by Rich Lowry in the Weekly Standard that argued that we're not just looking at a weak challenge to Hillary Clinton. If you look at the electoral map as it's shaping up today, Donald Trump would not just lose, but would really be trounced in a general election. As he put it, we're right now witnessing potentially the end of the Republican Party as it's constituted. And that sounds really, you know, hyperbolic, but it's not, actually. I mean, they really are confronting a moment in which, at the elite level and also certainly at the grassroots level, there really is no longer a coherent sense that the Republican Party is holding together.
And recriminations are flying. Some say that Jeb should have used his super PAC to crush Trump from the start. Others blame the whole GOP establishment for not listening to voters. Is this all just part of this ferment that we're watching?
I think it goes back even further than these recent decisions. I mean, it goes really back to some of the decisions that the party made, particularly in the Bush administration, about whether or not to hold fast to Reagan-era views on free trade and on how you bring about economic growth. The simple fact is that over the last generation, at the time that Paul Ryan and other Republican leaders today were coming up and were holding fast to these really traditional ideas about how you unleash growth, that while that was happening, that the base, the core of the Republican Party, was falling away. Blue-collar workers in these factories were finding themselves abandoned. And it was kind of simmering below the surface.
But wasn't the Tea Party, which sort of emerged suddenly in, what, 2009, wasn't that addressing some of this underlying ferment?
It was, but then the Tea Party turned out to be, I think, a contributing factor rather than a relief valve, because what happened was so many of the Tea Party candidates that eventually made it to Congress, they were elected on the basis of promises they simply could not keep, either because of the nature of our Constitution. I mean, for instance, a lot of those candidates got to Congress by saying that we will roll back Obamacare, and they simply never could do it. They didn't have the votes. In some cases, these things were sort of procedurally impossible. So what you had was this steady building of unrealistic expectations among a certain branch of the Republican Party. And if you go out, I've heard this at some Republican campaign events over the course of the last few months, I've heard people stand up over and over again and say, our leadership, meaning the Republican leadership, has lied to us. It's failed us. And that, I think in some ways, that was the unrecognized cancer that was eating at the center of the Republican Party's support. And it was only now that it became clear that people weren't just dissatisfied. They were, in fact, willing to overturn the whole enterprise.
Thank you so much, Evan. Evan Osnos is a staff writer and the author of Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker on your podcast app. You can find more political analysis and commentary from Evan Osnos and others on NewYorker.com or on the New Yorker app, available at no extra charge from the App Store and Google Play. Tell us what you thought of this podcast. Rate and review the Politics and More podcast on iTunes. This podcast is produced by Alex Barron for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.